everybody. Welcome to Endcast. I'm Zach Birchie. My co-host, Lindsay Loveridge, is here.
Hey, guys.
All right. So now, this is the Fushigi Yugi episode, which is coming up in just a little bit here. But there was another thing that came out last night called The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. And I could not in good conscience, I would go to my grave regretting not immediately talking about this thing because I love The Dark Crystal. And I am a huge, like, lifelong fan of Jim Henson. And this thing was like the fucking, in a year where there was also a movie called The Lion King, this is like the media event of the summer for me. Lindsay, I asked you to put this on. Now, it just came out a few hours ago, so we didn't have time to watch all 10 hours of the fucking thing. But I asked you to put it on. What did you think of what you saw?
I'm going to watch this whole thing.
Yeah. Right?
Right.
It's fucking good.
Okay, so, so I mean, my Jim Henson fandom is probably not at the same level as yours.
No, but no one's is.
But he has created a couple of things that I am a fan of. I watched The Dark Crystal as a kid. Mm-hmm. I have memories of watching it at my grandma's house. She might have had a copy of that and Jurassic Park. So whenever I was there, that's what we watched on VHS because there's nothing else to do.
Sure.
So I grew up with the original show. The original movie, and I remember revisiting it. And I guess I never acknowledged that they were puppets when I was a kid. Wow. So when I came back and watched it as an adult, I was like, oh, shit, these are like marionettes. Oh, OK.
They're puppets, but yeah.
They're puppets.
They're enormous. In many cases, they're like enormous animatronics.
OK.
Like they're operated by remote control in many cases. But they are you still have to stick your hand up its ass and like.
There's no strings attached, is what you're telling me.
Yes.
So they're not marionettes. There's no strings.
There are no strings on them, yes.
To hold them down.
Yeah.
Okay. That one in particular, and of course Labyrinth was another one I watched a lot as a kid.
I mean,
because my uncle had that on VHS, so if we were at his house, I watched it, and I always loved the scene, where they go into the crystal ball, and she's in the beautiful dress and dancing with David Bowie, the masquerade scene.
Uh-huh.
So, surprise. Okay. And both of those, I believe Jim Henson worked with Brian Froud on those.
Yes, he did indeed. And so, all right. So, let me get into The Dark Crystal.
Okay.
So, this movie came out in 1982. And Henson, in order to get this shit made, because it is a huge, hugely ambitious project, which you wouldn't think people would green light that. Right.
This one, I'm surprised that, like, this was greenlit. This was only greenlit because the movie existed. Because 1982, this isn't based on anything.
No, it's original. And it's Jim Henson's gigantic passion project. In order to get this made, he also had to make The Great Muppet Caper, one of my other favorite movies, at the same time. He had to make these two at once, right? Which is fucking intense when you
sounds
think
sounds exhausting.
It. Well, it's fucking I mean, like he worked real fucking hard to see his vision come to life. Now he made these two movies at the exact same time, and the original idea for The Dark Crystal, the movie was no English, so it wouldn't have had any English in it, and the puppets would just be screeching at each other in a foreign language. For the entire time. And he showed that cut to studios. He showed that cut to the studio. He showed up, like, it's such big art. Like, it's huge art. Like, they had to fucking murder themselves to make this thing in 1982. Right? Like,
yeah. Yeah. So the idea was that what you were going to be able to connect with the characters and sort of like decipher.
Well, it's
this despite the language barrier,
I suppose. I don't know, you know, whatever he was thinking. I think it's like I think he got together with the Frauds and was like, OK, let's fucking go for it. Let's fucking go for it. Nobody would make that unless he was going to make another Muppet movie. So,
yeah.
obviously the first cut got rejected, and he went on to make The Dark Crystal, which exists as it is. Him and Brian Froud and Frank Oz, I think, are the chief artists on that one. Brian and Wendy Froud are the chief architects of that. And I've always been completely fascinated with it. So when Netflix said, yo, we're going to make fucking 10 hours of The Dark Crystal, I was like, are you fucking serious? Are you really going to make 10 hours of The Dark Crystal?
You're like, is it my birthday and Christmas at the same time?
And apparently they did. So obviously we didn't have enough time to watch the whole thing, but I'm about an hour in and I am in love. I am in love with this thing. I think it not only captures the magic of the original, you know, with a little more CG, but they didn't have CG back then. They probably would have used it if they could. A little more CG, but it, like, just having an entire thing where there's nothing but puppets is so good. It's so good. And the story seems good. It's dealing with some daddy issues, which, you know, that's my jam. and so far, it seems great to me. I am very happy with it.
Yeah, they've introduced a capable heroine already.
Yeah. Well, you know, so that was one thing that I was really focused on, was like, okay, say what you will about some of the other Muppet stuff. Some of the things the Jim Henson Company has made since Jim passed away in the early 90s has not been very good. And I felt like it didn't quite copy his ethos, which is very strong. It's very strong. Like, you watch all of his work, his ethos runs very thick through all of it. It's really specific. I can sum it up pretty easily. There's a line in the song from the Happiness Hotel song in The Great Muppet Caper where someone says, "We got every kind of critter, we got every kind of pest, but we treat them all as equals, just like any other guest."
Aww. It's
basically the Henson ethos, like, just in one thing. And it's perfect. Man, I love that movie too. So this seems like it's doing that as well. The only thing is, it is also going to be 10 hours of, like, I've seen The Dark Crystal a lot, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I know what happens already, because they tell you what happens in the original movie, in the 1982 movie. Do you remember that scene where Jen and Kira, they're in front of those murals and the Chamberlain shows up?
No, I don't. It's been a while since I visited the original movie.
Well, they outline what happens to the Gelflings, and it's genocide. So the Gelflings are all going to get killed.
But isn't this a prequel?
Yes, it is. It happens.
So the murals are of the past.
In the original, yes, in the original film, they're the last two Gelflings.
Oh shit!
Yeah, so that's where it's going.
Oh no!
That's my weekend.
Oh no! Because I mean, the Gelflings are so cute. They're like these little kind of fairy people. You know, some of them have wings. Some of them, I'm not going to enjoy that.
I'm not quite sure how it's going to play out, but based on just the first episode, I can already see. All right, okay, you're heading here. Other thing is, this is set way before, so. And they intend on making more if it's popular enough. So I think maybe they don't go the full genocide route. Maybe they don't. I don't know. I'll find out very soon.
It sounds like it's your job to keep it just running on like a separate TV constantly so you can up the numbers on that and continue to get more Dark Crystal.
Sure. Yeah. Keep it coming. Keep it coming. Like, if you're going to give... The only thing is, like, you know, I don't know. Did you see the movie The Happy Time Murders?
No, I did not see the Melissa McCarthy movie.
Don't fucking ever watch that. Watch that. It was a total corruption of the Henson ethos, a total corruption of the Henson Company. It was disgusting.
Were they actually involved? I thought it was just knockoff.
No, that's them.
Oh, okay.
That's I think that's Brian Hansen. Brian Henson. So yeah, it's so what I'm hoping for is this is good and they stick to, you know, the quality of what Henson originally made. And it seems like it's that already. It already seems like it's that.
Yeah.
It's honestly fucking astonishing to see this much puppetry in a show. Like, now, I'm a big fan of puppets, but it's really astonishing to see something like this. I'm very, very pleased with it. Anyway.
I'm a big Froud fan as far as like their art goes in general.
Yeah.
I have, if I can like toot my horn here for a second, I have a set of Oracle cards that is just all Froud art. They're like official Oracle cards, and it came with a hardback book for how to do readings with it that's full of the art and stuff.
Wow. And all right.
Yeah.
I'm going to come over and
never ever getting rid of those.
I'm going to come over and steal that. A huge fan of the Frouds. Like,
yeah,
they changed me somehow as a person. They're like incredible artists.
Yeah. I just love their aesthetic about everything. In the episode of this, there's a playfulness to it that I really liked. And it's just like in the minor details, like there's a part where these really, I think they're cute bugs come out. They're used as like a form of transportation, and they kind of like saunter out. They're kind of like millipedes, and then they like go into their little millipede armor, and then they like roll up under the carriage and they stay rolled and they work as like the wheels.
Yep. It's good.
Just that kind of stuff where it's like, man, you know, they had like pieces of paper out and they were like planning how the different like technology, quote unquote, works in this world and how to integrate it with these like cute bug shit. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that crap.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Okay. So it was a good recommendation on my part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, the dark crystal. All right. I got a good weekend ahead of me. Let's get to Kashigi Yugi. Okay, we're back. Today on the show, we are discussing the 1995 anime Fushigi Yugi, based on the manga by Yu Watase, who recently came out as non-binary, which, in my opinion, kind of recontextualized this show that I've been watching for like 20 years or something like that.
Yeah.
My guests today are former editor and lovely person, Bamboo Dong. Bamboo, thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me.
And from Anime Feminist and The Daily Dot, we've got Caitlin Moore here. Thanks for coming by.
Glad to be here.
And of course, Lindsay Leverage.
Hey, everybody.
So we all put ourselves through this thing again. And it's a little tough to know exactly where to start with this. But Caitlin, can you give us just sort of a brief recap of the beginning of Fushigi Yugi and what it is?
All right. So Fushigi Yugi is the story of Miyako Yuki, an ordinary Japanese middle school student trying to get into high school. And Miyako is not very smart. She's not very popular with the boys. And her friend Yui is pretty and intelligent. One day Miyako wanders into the restricted section of the library, opens up a book. Oh no, now she's in the book. She's been isekai'd. And so they tell her that she is the priestess of Suzaku, and she must gather the seven celestial warriors and summon the god Suzaku to grant her wishes. And of course she's like, hell yeah, wishes. One of these warriors is Tamahome, who is handsome, and she falls instantly in love. There's the Emperor Hotohori. There is the character of complicated gender discussion, Noriko. Mitsukake the healer, Tosuke the bandit, Chichiri the monk, And so she has to wander around finding all these guys, and a bunch of melodrama happens. Yui is also pulled in and becomes the priestess of Seryu, is having a very bad time because turns out Seryu is not good. Empire with Senpai Seryu is not good people. And at the end of the first half, they've got all the warriors. They summon Suzaku, except, oh no, one of the warriors is an imposter and things are fucked up forever. That's the first half of Fushigi Yugi.
Pretty good. So, Lindsay and I now have been watching this this past week, and it
2 weeks.
2 weeks because it's really, really long, and takes forever to get through. When's the last time you actually sat and watched this whole thing, Caitlin?
I watched the whole thing through, including the OAVs, for a series of podcasts with Anime Feminist about a year ago. And we discussed like an hour episode per like 7 episodes of the show. So not super duper mega recently, but it was a very in-depth discussion. So it's still very like strongly in my memory right now.
And for Bamboo, what about you?
I watched this maybe like 2 or 3 months ago. I was just very curious if it would hold up or not. And for the most part, I think it has. This is like, I have to say that this was like the first anime that I ever watched that I knew was anime. So for me, like a lot of this is just tied into just pure nostalgia.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, what about, and Lindsay, you've obviously been watching it.
Yeah, I've watched it recently, but prior to that, I had not watched it in almost 20 years. And it wasn't until I got later into the show that I realized that I never, ever saw the ending to this until now.
Ooh.
So this is probably the first time I've actually seen it all the way through.
Yeah, I've obviously seen it quite a lot, but I had not revisited it in quite a while. And I gotta be honest, I think it's aging really well. It's a good story. It's a silly soap opera. Like it follows the rules of shoujo anime pretty closely, I think. But it still has like a lot of good shit in it. Like I appreciated it very differently now than I did back then. And it especially the first half, I think, is the strongest half, because the second half, I think, it's to kind of starts to fall apart a little bit.
Yes, but it gets to be a little misery porn in parts of the second half.
Yeah, a little bit there. But, you know, you're trying to write something that has to run forever. Like, it's like Shoujo Jump, right? Like, it has to run forever, so it's got to be like this. So I kind of got what she was what they were going for. And this time, sincerely, I don't know if you guys remember the 90s. But people fucking hated Miyaka, like hated her, and were really, really mean about it, too. Like, just cruel. And I kind of feel like I know where that's coming from now. Now I'm like, oh, Miyaka's my second favorite character. Like, she's very relatable. Like, and that's by design. You know, this is mass entertainment that was hugely popular. So, of course, she's supposed to be relatable. But did any of you run into that sort of Miyaka hate back in the day?
Oh yeah.
I mean, I've had sort of an arc with my relationship with the series where it's like when I first watched it in bits and pieces when I was 12, and I really loved it. I got the VHS piecemeal from the library,
right?
And then, like, as I grew older, it became trendy to not hate on not just Miyaka, but on the series as a whole. And so I sort of got on that train for a while. It's like, yeah, Fushigi Yugi, like, I used to really like it, but, you know, it's really dumb, and Miyaka's, like, a really, like, weak and useless heroine. But then with my most recent rewatch, I've really come to embrace, like, the series as a whole and Miyaka as well. More like probably more than I did before. I think the narrative doesn't always do right by her, but she's still a good character.
Well, it to me it seems pretty direct. Like Miyaka's always trying to solve everything with empathy. She's always trying to solve things that way instead. She stops people from hurting themselves and each other and tells them like, no, it, hey, hang on, it's all right, you know? And I really appreciated that. I was like, oh, it's me.
Yeah, she's a really kind person.
Yeah, she's very kind. And the hate in the 90s was so strong. And that became kind of like a meme, almost. Like, if you're going to talk about Fushigi Yugi, the first thing you have to say is that Miyaka is dumb and it's bad. Like, which, that's not true. It's not bad. It's basically like every other Jump anime, except for whatever reason this is basically a harem show for girls, and so of course people fucking hated it. Like, of course people were weird and hatey on it. Like, it kind of all came together for me while I was sitting watching it. Like, oh, I understand why people are so shitty about this one, because it's well, all right, I'll just come out and say it. It's not for straight men, so of course it got a lot of fucking hate. But watching it again, I really appreciated Miyaka. I really, there's a lot of moments in there where it makes it, like, it, I understand the emotional angle that the show is going for, even though it is like a super silly melodrama. I still get what they're going for. Like, I got it.
I think you have to just accept that, yeah, sometimes Miyaka acts in a way that it's easy to, like, look at the show itself and be like, oh, well, that's dumb. Why don't they just talk to each other? Why doesn't she tell anyone where she's going? Or why doesn't she ever rely on Tamahome? She's always, like, running away from him to go solve the problems by herself. And it's like, well, because otherwise there wouldn't be anything to do. And that's not, like, unique to Fushigi Yugi. That's shoujo manga as a whole. People don't communicate because it's more dramatic or more exciting to have all these miscommunications or misunderstandings to perpetuate the drama of the show.
Yeah.
I mean, there were definitely parts where I got frustrated because, like, it seemed like they were only doing that for, like, it's like, why are you doing this? Why are you running off again, Miyaka? This never works out.
Right.
But, like, which is frustrating. And it's it's not the great storytelling. And I think a lot of parts of Fushigi Yugi have, like, really good storytelling. But that part was, and that tended to happen more in the, like,
second half.
It happened more in the second half, which is, when kind of the story hit the doldrums for a little while.
Yeah.
But it like, and another thing is, like, a lot of times when Miyaka tries to be active and make her own decisions, things, that's when, like, she kind of fucks things up.
Well, I mean, you know, so do I.
Same here. that can be sort of frustrating as a viewer. It's like, okay, like, you know, let the heroine be a little active without being punished for it. But, like, she's still, you know, very, like, she's very kind and she's very lovable and she tries her best, even though, like, she fucks up and she tries her best and she fucks up and she keeps trying her best.
She really does.
I can't hate on her for that.
Yeah, she really tries her. She tries her goddamnest. Like, it's, I guess, I suppose I understand the rules of long running shoujo storytelling enough to know where all of this is coming from. It recontextualized it for me, seeing it again finally after so long, that, like, oh, I get what you're doing. I get you. All right. I got you.
I think you could compare it to, like, the long-running parts of a shoujo anime are kind of comparable to any shonen fight that, like, goes on for episodes upon episodes and they're powering up all the time. It's not any, it's the same idea. It's just, like, recontextualized for a different audience.
All right.
So, she's very much a heroine of the 90s, you know, like, there was, like, in that era, there was just a certain type of hero that always seemed to have, you know, similar characteristics. Like, they were a little bit clumsy. They loved to eat a lot. Yeah. They were a little bit, you know, this and that, but boy, were they brave, and boy, were, you know, they were just okay with, like, sacrificing themselves for love and friendship. And so, like, that was always just that era, right?
Right.
Not at school, but man, they will stab themselves if they need to.
Yeah, they draw similarities twofold between her and, like, Usagi from Sailor Moon a couple right. times, especially in the beginning. And that's because the voice actress is Kai Araki, who is the voice of Chibiusa in Sailor Moon. Oh, so, yeah, it's the same voice actress. So there's a couple times at the beginning where she does, like, the Sailor Moon pose, or there's, like, another reference at some point, too, to kind of, like, point out, like, yes, I'm also this other heroine from the 90s, too. But, yeah, I agree with Bamboo that there's very much – that was very much a prototype. I was starting to think of whether, like, Hitomi from Escaflowne fits any of that, too.
No. Hitomi's way more capable.
Yeah, Hitomi is not the same type of character at all.
It's been a long time since I revisited that show, and all I remember is, you know, the, like, love triangle and the drama, and that's pretty much it.
So. Yeah. No, it's not quite the same, but the comparison between Miyaka and Usagi is accurate, I would say, and obvious. Let's discuss these characters. So first, Tamahome. whose name you have heard over and over, if you watched this recently,
whose name before you... Inuyasha, Kagome, there was Miyaka, Tamahome.
Yeah, indeed. That's a good comparison. So how did Tamahome come across to you, Lindsay?
When he's first introduced, he's sort of like, if I had to compare him to anything, kind of a Han Solo type. So he's like, you know, he's out for his own money, but he's got, like, roguish charm, you know, capable in a fight, so he could protect you, but he's not going to coddle you too much. That's supposed to, I think, kind of be his appeal. And, you know, eventually it's taming him, so to speak. That's supposed to be, like, sort of the romantic pull there is like, that's oh, good. You know, he that's was good. Sort of wild before, but not in...
Putting
not,
a saddle on.
But in a safe way. You know, he was wild before, but now he only has eyes for me, and he's going to settle down for me.
Yeah.
That's sort of his appeal, I think.
The Edward Cullen, perhaps, of Fushigi.
Okay.
Bamboo, what do you think?
Tamahome was my first boyfriend.
Okay.
And I still love him to this day. Because, look, the moment when you find out, like, sure, he seems like super aloof and cool, but it's just because he's protecting his family. And, like, you know, it's sappy and cliched, but I think it's a good moment. And also, he's very handsome. And Midori Kawahiguru has a voice that is like soft velvet. What's not to like?
Right. So Bamboo touches on, he's also got that nurturing point there that's supposed to be appealing too. He cares about his family. He helped raise his little sister. He's a hard worker to provide for them when they don't have much. That's another.
Of course, then they all get murdered in front of him.
God, that's
God. That part was that was a low.
Don't worry, their spirits come back later to murder their murderer. Which is fucking weird.
Caitlin, what about you?
I really like Tamahome. I think I like him more now that I'm in my 30s than I did in my teens. I think Bamboo nailed it really well. He's really nurturing. Like, I think the reason, like, he and Miyaka, the foundation for their relationship is really shaky, i.e. he's handsome and he helped her, so she's in love with him.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's
how it goes.
once the relationship has, like, started, I think he's a really sweet boyfriend to her. He's generally very supportive. Like, there's a part in the second half that really touched me when Miyaka thinks she's been raped, and he's just like, I feel like a lot of shoujo boyfriends would, like, blame her or, like, tell her that she's tainted. And, like, Tamahome is just like, you're still Miyaka. You're still the person I care about. You're not tainted. You're not dirty. Like, what he did to you was wrong. And so, like, that really, that really stuck out to me. So except for the parts where they're not communicating because of melodrama, I think they're really good together. And he's sweet. And I'm a dub person when it comes to Fushigi Yugi, and David Hayter is really charming as him.
Oh, that's Hayter, huh?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that. I always watch everything subtitled, but that's cool.
The dub has nostalgia value for me.
I always think about like how different shows like this would be if this was in an era with cell phones. You know, like how much of this would have been prevented. Where's Miyaka? Yeah. Don't worry, I'll just call her.
Yeah. I'll just give her a call. You're right, exactly. I don't know. I didn't like completely appreciate Tamahome this time around. I thought it was kind of obvious why, because he literally has ogre printed on his fucking forehead. And so him being kind of a brute sometimes is to be expected. And I felt like I understood the character a little bit more this time around. The character is obviously like the center. It's basically the center of the show, aside from Miyaka. And it centers around their relation, their romance, so to speak, very, very directly. And it does get kind of annoying hearing them scream each other's names over and over and over and over and over again. So I can kind of understand some of the complaints, but like, it's still a good character. It's a good character.
I think he'd hold up in a romance still now. Like, I think all of the things that make him appealing, they aren't dated. You could stick that same type of character in another shoujo romance now, and he would still work as the hero of the story.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. Moving on to Hotohori. Caitlin, how do you feel about that guy?
Hotohori's an asshole.
Yeah, he sure is.
That is one character I did sour on over the years. Tamahome started looking better. Hotohori looks so much worse now. He's just constantly like, Miyaka, I'm in love with you. It's like, no, you're not in love with her. You're in love with the idea of her. You don't know her.
Oh, that's good.
And he's like pushing her down to the bed and like pressuring her. And like, he's a total creep. And and he dies for no reason, if you think about it. Like, he goes out and gets himself killed and accomplishes nothing. Like, no, Hotohori kind of sucks, actually. But he's very pretty. When he takes off his crown and all of his hair comes cascading down, that's very nice.
Yeah. That's a good take. Bamboo, what about you?
You know, I think Hotohori is actually one of the least developed characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't, you know, he just sort of shows up and then he's like the emperor and that's it. And so his sole appeal lies in the fact that he has nice hair and he's the emperor. And that's actually the only side that he even presents to Miyaka too. I'm the emperor. I have nice hair. I can protect you. But the latter part is moot because they all protect her. So he doesn't have anything that's, I feel like, entirely unique to him. He's always like, he's the vanilla character of Fushigi Yugi.
He's definitely sidelined by the end of the last two thirds of the show. Like, he doesn't travel with them most of the time because he's the emperor and he's stuck doing paperwork or whatever in ancient China paperwork. So he doesn't get the same experiences with Miyaka with traveling with her, and I think that weakens like the prospect of their relationship too. You're like, this guy's never here. Why would you be? You don't. He's always back at the castle. Like,
it is. It's kind of strange to me that he's centered. Well, not strange. I suppose it makes sense, but he's centered as the I mean, not to continually reference Twilight here, but he's sort of the werewolf boy. Like,
are you sure you don't have this backwards?
He's way more of an Edward.
Yeah,
whatever.
And Hotohori is definitely more of a Jacob.
You know what I mean.
Miyaka chose the Jacob.
She made the right decision.
Okay. All right. Whatever you think is fine. But that is kind of, it's strange to me because like Bamboo was saying, characters are really underdeveloped and is also a creep, like Caitlin was saying. I don't know. I personally, like, not my favorite character in this thing. And anytime the story is centered on Hotohori, I'm just like, all right.
I loved him when I was 12.
He was my favorite when I first watched it too. Yeah, yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I was 14. Don't ask me why I made any decision at that age. Probably because he could like buy me pretty dresses and stuff. I don't really know.
He had pretty hair and a nice voice.
Yeah, yeah. He has a nice voice.
Pretty hair, nice voice. You know, sometimes that's how it goes. That character, I think, is sort of aging, not poorly, but differently than a lot of the others. So back in the day, the most popular character was always Chichiri. And this time I thought his voice and his character were sort of introduced to basically like stop everyone from being dumb. Like,
yeah,
like they need an adult.
He's like the mentor of the group.
Yeah, he's an adult. Caitlin, what do you think of Chichiri?
I mean, I love Chichiri. Like, he's a good guy. I have this theory that Fushigi Yugi is a sort of about Miyaka facing the positive and negative aspects of like different things that she's has anxieties about. And Chichiri in this sort of reading of it sort of represents positive relationships with adults. Like, you know, he offers her guidance and mentoring and experience without like manipulation or judgment.
Right. That's good.
That's going to be a good character, right? He's gone through some shit. His voice in Japanese is Seki Tomokazu, who apparently is an asshole now. I feel like I've heard something about that, but then I couldn't find it again. But he was a good actor.
He's still active. He's
a really good voice actor. He was like the first voice actor that I learned to recognize, and part of that was because of his performance as Chichiri.
No da. Yeah.
No da.
Bamboo, what about you?
I've always loved him, of course, but you know, he's an interesting character, I think, for people to sort of glom onto as favorite boy, because the fact that he wears a mask the entire time, right? I mean, you know, of course there's that amazing reveal when you see his face and you're like, oh, turns out he's like drop dead gorgeous. But it's I've always found it interesting that basically, you know, the character that you're liking is an active facade, right? It's this like wall of a character that you're seeing who is the wise one, but he's also the sort of like chipper funny one. I don't know. I think because of that, like, you know, it makes him interesting, but at the same time, it's also I've always questioned people for whom he's the favorite, because
I think it's easy to endear yourself to Chichiri because of the whole mask thing. It's like, oh, he has this actual deep pain behind his happy facade. You know, there's more to him, and he'd show it only to me if I, you know, broke down his walls. This is totally what his archetype is.
Yeah.
But I think that we can't ignore that he like straight up killed a dude. He just murdered a dude for running away with his fiance.
They go into that in the OAVs. It's a little bit more complicated.
Yeah. Thankfully, we don't have to necessarily discuss the OVAs.
Yeah, that's good, because they're kind of disasters.
Yeah. Well, it's got to run forever, right? Yuitase needs to keep those checks coming in. So, I don't know. I appreciated his character a little bit more this time, but I think Bamboo kind of nailed it. Like, if that's your favorite character in this show, it's a little surface, you know. But that's direct. It's pretty direct in the show itself. He's literally wearing a fucking mask. So,
he's Dee's favorite character.
A little surface, though.
Because I would argue that Kamehome fulfilled a similar role in which it is like, oh, like, because he's let me in to his sensitive side and the side that cares about his family, only I truly know who he is.
Yeah.
And everyone else
right.
is like, right. you know? So,
yeah.
I feel like it's like surface level Kamehome.
Yeah.
I said it.
Yeah. Well, it's a harem fantasy. So, you know, that's kind of how it goes. So, why don't we talk a little bit about the show's version of Bakugo, Toski, the fire boy. Caitlin, how do you feel about
Toski? Oh, I love Toski.
He just doesn't get very much screen time, but
he doesn't get to do enough, which is really unfortunate because he's so like he's really fun. And he gets more screen time than certain other characters. He's a lot of fun. He's like the very approachable type of character, so he has like really good dynamics with most of the other characters. The rare glimpse we get into even his relationship with Chirico is really sweet. He's just every time he's on screen, I'm just like, yeah, it's Toski.
Hey, here he is. Yeah.
Here he is.
He's mostly like a comedic foil, I think, right? Like I feel like his main purpose in the show is to lighten the mood or, you know, add a little slapstick to a scene or something like that.
Yeah, or to like open his mouth and say something dumb and everyone gets mad at him.
Right.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. He has some pathos, but not as much as the other characters.
Bamboo, what about you?
He's great. He's a bad boy. And he's super fun. Like, he's like, you know, he's the bro.
Yeah.
He's got the bandit dance.
He's got the bandit. He's his best friend. So he also has a sensitive side.
He cares about his other thieves, you know.
Yeah, I'm beginning to realize that actually every single character has a sensitive side as long as you get to know them long enough. Like the more that we start going through these characters, I'm like, oh wait a minute. It turns out they're all just like slightly different versions of the same dude. Except they love you. And you really know them. But it's just like different versions of like, oh, he really cares about his friends. Oh, he really cares about his family. Oh, he really cares about his dead wife. There's a lot of dead wives. But, yeah, you know, there's just like, oh, he really cares. Whatever. It's this weird thing of like masculinity. Or are they actually sensitive?
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. I like that. So a lot of the other characters are, in my opinion, kind of meaningless. Mitsukake, for example.
The old dude.
I appreciated the episode with that centered on him because Miyaka solves the problem with empathy and is like, but wait, you know, his wife is like turning into a demon or something. And she's like, but wait, don't you love him? Don't you love him? And she's like, oh, gosh, I suppose I do. Well, don't fight. Don't fight. So that's good. But then the character does basically fucking nothing. Like,
well, his cat, though.
He has a cat. But
he has a cat.
He's the Kevin Richardson of the Suzaku Seishi. Like, he's like the old one. So if you like old dudes, he's your dude. And then if you like little kids, you know, Chirico is your one.
Right.
You know?
Yeah,
it's
okay.
Just the broad range. The old dude, the little kid, and then like the actual men in the middle with their sensitive sides.
Right. Yeah. I didn't have a strong opinion on him, and we will get to Nudiko.
Saving best for last.
Chirico, I also don't have a strong take.
Chirico didn't really get to
do much
of anything.
God, his death though. It's like you didn't get to do anything, and then it's like now you're possessed by a demon and you have to shank yourself multiple times with a top and you're just like jabbing it in his leg over and over again.
That was messed up.
What did he do? Upsetting. What did he do to deserve that? Like what karmic retribution is? Yeah. But I mean, couldn't they have just had him fall off a cliff like everybody else at least once? Yeah. Like did he have to
Yeah, that was a rough one. Yeah. That was rough. But I also, like, the character just wasn't developed all that well and didn't have that much to do aside from wait around to die, so...
Because he was supposed to be, like, the strategy behind whatever they were doing. He was supposed to be the smart one, but there's not a whole lot of strategy behind whatever the Sakura 7 is doing.
Kinda... Yeah, it's sort of veering around. Like,
yeah.
The story just kind of slides all over the place for a little while. So it
after he comes in is kind of when the story falls apart for a little while.
Yeah, that's true.
So
yeah, absolutely.
It is interesting that the two characters who aren't trying to bang Miyaka are the ones that like aren't actually fleshed out. It's like she wrote a certain number of characters and then realized like, shit, I have to get up to 7. All right. Old one, young one.
Right.
Just roll the dice on the characteristics.
It's a good way of putting it, I think. Let's talk about, not to get into this too early, but let's talk about Nuriko.
Nuriko.
Who is my new favorite character?
Of Fushigi Yugi or of all time?
Fushigi Yugi.
Okay.
She's great. And always, in my opinion, every time she's on screen, she always cuts right to it. She gets right to the chase. Like, she does not fuck around. Smart, kind, and even, like, her stupid-ass death with the Seiryu warrior.
Like, werewolf.
The werewolf guy. Even in her death, what she's saying is... Like, it's not, it's framed very differently, and honestly, it plays really different now that Watase came out as non-binary. It plays really different now, I think. Like, there's some stupid stuff in there. There's some awkwardness to it, of course, because it's from the early 90s. But in the end, what she says is, well, but I loved everyone. I loved all of them. Not just Miyaka, but I loved my family. I thought that was great. Mm-hmm. Like, and really direct, like really obvious, like what's happening here. And this is the way that Watase was able to insert a queer character into something, into early 90s anime, which was not a thing. That was not really a thing back then.
And Fushigi Yugi was written in 1992.
It was.
Like, so it's even like even earlier than like
even earlier.
When the anime came out.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I get it now. I think I get it. And I think she's my favorite.
I think contextually, like before this information about Watase came out, it was easy to be critical of Nuriko because it looked like a gay character or a trans character. It looked like a trans character who midway through just decides that their identity as a woman was like a coping mechanism and they're not really trans anymore. And now maybe they're not gay anymore either. And I could see how people were originally critical of that, looking at it that way. But then if you look at Nuriko as non-binary, it makes a lot more sense. It's more like, well, both of these are me. I'm these things simultaneously. I'm more this way sometimes and I'm more that way sometimes, but both of them are me.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, it's messy.
It is messy.
It's like messy. I mean, it's messy, but you know, I think Fushigi Yugi Uwatase was working out a lot of stuff about themselves throughout. And so like in retrospect, like Nuriko was probably part of them working things out. Like one of the lines is Nuriko wasn't really a guy or a girl. Nuriko was Nuriko.
Yeah.
See? And like,
it's good.
You know, like, you know, and it's like those problems that are there, the conflation of like gayness and transness and like, like all that, like they're still there. You know, it doesn't totally negate all of the issues, but like it really does sort of change the context for it.
It recontextualizes.
It does. It really does recontextualize it. And like you said, Zach, like Noriko is like total like common sense character, does not like put up with anyone else's bullshit.
Yep.
Like
always right. Like
so much trouble could have been avoided if they all just listened to Noriko from the start.
Yeah. It's the only character that's like just getting right to it every single time, which is like,
well, like even at the start when they were, it's like, well, Noriko's being kind of like horrible to Miyaka, and she's like, she just appeared and everyone's obsessed with her. What the hell? Like, that's not really a good reason to bully a teenage girl, but at the same time, what the hell?
But then they become good friends, and you know, it's good. It's a good character. I firmly believe that Watase coming out as non-binary recontextualizes that to the point where she, Noriko really is the strongest character in the show, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Bamboo.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Do you think that recontextualizes the dream sequence as well?
Yes, it does.
Remind me of the dream sequence. I'm not sure.
The dream sequence is where they're together in the real world. And
oh, okay.
Noriko is wearing men's clothes and her hair is short.
And going out on a date.
And they go going out on a date. But I don't know. Have you spent a lot of time around trans people? Because if you have, this sequence makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. Your identity is whatever you make it. And they refer to Noriko again and again and again. Like Caitlin was saying, Noriko is just Noriko, not not a he or a she, just, you know, this all comes together. It all connects. There's just
Bamboo, I don't know if you felt this way. When I watched the sequence, it didn't seem overtly romantic to me.
Yeah.
It felt like them hanging out.
Exactly. And now I think it's interesting watching it now, sort of understanding Watase as almost like maybe in another world, you know, this is how I would have wanted my life to be. Like, I could just be myself and be pals with Miyaka. You know, I could just go hang out, go shopping, do whatever. And maybe in that moment, maybe that is, like, the true reflection of Watase. You know, like, in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, maybe we could just hang out, eat food, and talk about cute boys. Maybe we could just do that.
Yeah,
I mean, Watase did say in an interview long before they came out that if they were reincarnated, they would want to be a cute boy who would flirt with girls.
All right.
So that does seem, that dream sequence does seem very similar to that.
It feels like the character is in the show, and when you're watching it, anytime she's on screen, she's always right about everything, gets right to it, and is the queer character in the show. So it connects to me. This connects to me. It all kind of makes sense, I think.
And I think the humor surrounding, or the jokes that are made at Noriko's expense during the show too, I think watching it with the new information about Watase, it feels less like Watase is mocking Noriko with the calling them an Okama and all of that, and more just like this is a reflection of how these issues, still to some extent in anime too, are treated by like the lay characters who, they're not queer and they don't know how to act around a queer person, or like, what's okay.
No, they don't. They don't. And frankly, for something from the early 90s, sneaking in a queer character like this is pretty good. That's pretty. She basically snuck this in. Like, it's like, well, also, there's this one. It's like, okay, all right. What are you doing here? I think it works. And like, I think a big part of my sort of defense of Nuriko comes from the fact that so many people have spent so much time ragging on this and acting as though, like, oh, you know, let's shit on this because it's not perfect representation or whatever. But it's, if you understand it in context, like what she was trying to, what they were trying to do, I think it makes sense. I think it connects. You know, it's not perfect, but it is pretty good. And I really, this time around, like, I really responded to Nerdy Call. I was like, oh, that's the best one. That's the good one. Let's talk about Yui.
Oh, Yui.
Caitlin,
oh,
Yui. Tell me about Yui.
Yui did a lot wrong, but it wasn't entirely her fault.
You think so?
Because she was being like manipulated and gaslit by Nakago the whole time. You know, like Nakago was like lying to her and telling her that Miyaka like didn't care about her, and just like Yui's a 15-year-old girl. Like 15-year-olds don't generally have a lot of sense, and she was traumatized.
This is some Yui apologism, like, here.
Oh,
okay. No, okay. Yeah. Yeah,
no, it's know, okay. I'm a Yui true. Apologist
it's
too.
True.
It's true.
She did a lot wrong. Like, I'm not gonna say it's like, oh well, Yui was completely innocent. Like, no, she made bad decisions, but she was traumatized, she was manipulated, she was gaslit. She was just in a really bad, vulnerable place, and she was taken advantage of. And like, it really spoke to me at the end when Yui is talking to Miyaka, like, oh my god, you must be so mad at me. And Miyaka's like, I'll yell at you later. Like, Yui's not automatically forgiven, but it's like, we'll take care of that then. Now we have this big thing to deal with. Like, you know, I have definitely become more fond of Yui over the years.
Really? Huh. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Lindsay, what'd you think?
Well, okay. So yeah, I'm a Yui apologist. Have been, always will be. For me, I think what lets me forgive her, and well, first I feel like I understand to a degree her trauma. And then what allows me to forgive her is knowing that the information she was provided was not only manipulated, but withheld from her for a large part of the show. Like, I don't think anyone ever tells her that, is it Amiboshi, like, murdered Tamahome's whole family, and then she continues to hang out with it, or is that Tsuboshi?
That's Tsuboshi.
Tsuboshi murders her whole family, and then, you know, he loves Yui or whatever, and he's a fucking creep. But she doesn't know that he ever did that. I think she doesn't know, for a large part, a lot of what the Seiru are doing. She's just sort of sequestered away and given limited information, and then Nakago is continually feeding into her complex about Miyaka being happy without her. I also think she's gay.
Huh.
There's a point in the show where I forget who asks her, and they're like, are you in love with Tamahome or are you in love with that girl? And she can't answer. And so a lot of the time, I think her obsession with Tamahome is actually completely misplaced feelings that she has for Miyaka that she won't face. Hot take.
Can I mention, extending my theory, like that my reading of it that I talked about earlier, Yui is kind of the other side of the coin of Miyaka has mostly positive experiences. Like, yeah, things get bad, but she has like a really supportive network to help her through it. And Yui is sort of the other side of the coin. While, you know, Miyaka had like the supportive adult figures, Yui had manipulative figures, where Miyaka, her like first love, her first like sexual experiences, like, you know, she doesn't actually have sex during the series, but like her first kiss and everything, like, were very positive. Like, Yui was assaulted. So Yui is sort of the other side of the coin of Miyaka, and is a big reversal because Yui had everything in the real world.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting. Bamboo, what's your take?
You know, when I first watched it, I did not like Yui. You know, I thought she was kind of a bitch. I thought she was mean, but it's as you watch the series and the more you rewatch the series, like, the more I think you are naturally sympathetic towards Yui, because the things that she does are not her fault. And the reactions that she has towards, you know, the various events are also completely understandable given the experiences that she's gone through. You know, the first half of the series, essentially, you know, she is following on all of Miyaka's adventures, right? She's reading the book, seeing what's going on. She cares deeply about Miyaka. And then, you know, Miyaka leaves and, you know, pieces out for like 24 hours. Within that span, you know, she doesn't know where Yui is. And then because of that, like, not only is Yui being gaslit in this horrible environment in which people are total assholes and not like the Suzaku Seishi, but she also feels neglected because in her mind, like, okay, I've just spent this entire time following Miyaka on her journey. Where is she?
Right.
And it's heartbreaking when you think about all the things that she went through. So I think now, like, as I've had more life experience, I think it's very difficult to dislike Yui, knowing all the things that she went through.
The scene in the temple where, like, she confronts Miyaka and is, like, crying and screaming at her, like, breaks my heart so much.
Yeah, it's a rough one. That's a rough one.
And you know, her whole thing with, like, Tamahome, I mean, it's not fair, you know, he did meet them at the same time. And why in one case you have this, like, romance where this guy would literally try to find her for, like, thousands of years or whatever, and then the other she gets like a psychopath. I mean, it's not fair. And
yeah,
this is such, like, an interesting clear-cut example of how, like, two girls who are start out similar, even though, like, you know, Yui is the smart one, she's the hardworking one, she's the one who's up until this point done everything right, how life can still diverge.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that. I admittedly am not a Yui fan. I think if you just sort of join the fascists because they're the first ones who get to you, then you're not thinking about this very clearly. But I understand the point of the character, and it made a lot more sense this time around, I think. Y'all have very good points about that.
I don't know that she had a choice either.
Well, right? I mean, it's shoujo anime, so, you know, like, I understand the point of the character is to mirror Miyaka. That's the point, is like, oh, right. But what if there's also an evil one?
Right,
like, that's kind of the point. But it made a lot more sense this time around. I'm just slightly less apologetic towards Yui and her behavior, and the way that she responds to all of this stuff and the actions that she takes. I think I'm a little less like, oh, well, literally none of it is her fault. Well, I don't know if that's true, but the character makes a lot more sense, made a lot more sense this time to me. So with that in mind, let's talk about Nakago. Caitlin, what's your take on Nakago?
Fuck Nakago.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
That's my entire take on Nakago. Fuck Nakago.
All right, Lindsay.
All right, so Nakago's a bad guy, but let's talk about why Nakago is appealing. Can we do that? Is this dark?
Okay.
Is this too dark?
This is going to get dark.
Gosh. Oh, edgy.
We're going to get
edgy in here.
It's going to get edgy, yeah. All right.
Yeah, Nakago's whole point is to be the alluring bad guy who rips your corset off, but you secretly wanted it the whole time. That's his entire, like, fictional point.
Yep.
Like, what is that sort of thing applicable in real life relationships? No. But Nakago is a fantasy character where he's a sexy villain. He might make out with your boyfriend too sometimes if he feels like it. You know, he seems pretty up for anything. He's up for anything, all right? He has no family or attachments to anyone else, so he only wants you. And I don't know. He's probably really good in bed. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh, jeez.
He was sexually abused.
Okay, Caitlin, what's your Caitlin, please respond.
he was his whole backstory is that he was sexually abused as a small child. Yeah. So like it's
so he's also probably deep down got a soft sensitive side that he would only reveal to you.
Yeah, this is like
favorite character.
He's who?
He's Yubatase's favorite character.
Is he really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's kind of a troll, though. That's a troll. My favorite character is Nakago. Yeah, all right. Okay. All right, settle down.
Mr. Yet.
Yeah, so, yeah, his only, I think his, the Nakago's thing is Nakago Fox. That's it. That's...
He does lick Tamahome in the face.
He does. Yeah.
I thought he full mouth kisses one of the guys, doesn't he?
Does he?
I think
yeah,
so.
Yeah, like at the very end as a distraction tactic. And then he's like, ha, I can always get you guys this way. And it's like, yeah, but you always also do that. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean... No, Nakago is definitely like evil bisexual.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Nakago's a theater kid.
A theater kid? He's a bi furious. Theater kid.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, God. I suppose so. I suppose that's true. He's a malevolent bisexual. They definitely exist, I'll tell you.
it's a trope. It's a trope.
Yeah.
It's a not ideal trope, but well.
Well, anyway. I did want to ask before we move into the end of the show, the second half. So this show has a tremendous amount of sexual assault in it, references to it and sort of hints at it and constantly kind of brings it up. That happens all the time in Fushigi Yugi. And I was curious, Caitlin, what do you think of that material?
It's not the best. In places it makes sense because like I said, the anxiety stuff, there's a stretch of episodes in the latter half where everyone, I think there's like five attempted rapes against Miyaka.
Yeah, and like at least three or four people, I think.
Like it's like Tsubashi, what's his face? The gay guy.
Tomo, I think.
Tomo, thank you.
Yeah.
I was like, Taka, no, that's Tamahome's reincarnation. Nakago, like, it just keeps happening. And it's like, come on, guys, stop. So, yeah, it's definitely overused. I'm not going to make excuses for that. I think the stuff with Yui thematically makes sense, but it definitely goes too far.
What do you think, Babu?
I don't want to say that it's lazy because I feel like we only think it's lazy because we've been so inundated with it over the past like 20 years in media. But it is like literary shorthand for like, oh, this is a terrible thing that happens. And I think in the show, what's particularly bad about it, you know, you can see how the threat of it is held over Yui's head, right? This knowledge of, oh, you were totally raped, and just the trauma of that alone completely changes her, even though, you know, later he's like, ah, psych, you weren't. That to me is, I think, almost worse in a weird way than all of the sexual assault in the show. The fact that it's, like, weaponized.
Yeah, there's, like, they literally go, she thinks she's been raped by Nakago and she gets away. And I can't remember if she discovers it's not true or not, but then is immediately like put in that dream world with Tomo, who's planning to rape her under false pretenses, only to get out of that and be confronted by Tsuboshi.
Oh my God.
Who then on a cliff, who then threatens to rape her. And then Tamahome falls off a cliff. And I think in that same night, Tamahome falls off a cliff, is rescued by a family, gets back to health, and like gets back on top of the cliff before it's all over or something. But it's literally like one, two, three different dudes, same threat, one right after each other. She's like standing in her underwear when Tsuboshi's there. And it's just,
it's gross that it's threatened.
Yeah, it's gross that it's threatened. I mean, there's always the underlying stuff with this female targeted media that it's supposed to make you, it's supposed to be tantalizing in a way at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, they all want her. Wouldn't it be hot? No, I don't. This guy looks like a reject from Kiss. I don't want to watch that.
I mean, he's also gay, so it was purely a pragmatic thing for her.
Yeah.
I suppose that's true. I don't know, like, so I don't know if you all have read a lot of shoujo manga. But there is a tremendous amount of this sort of material in it, always. And it's a trope. Because now, all right, here's my theory. Take a seat. Everyone is basically kind of a bottom. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the term bottom, but people are bottoms. And what that means is you want to be desired. You want to be so desired that you're irresistible to people. This is the fantasy that they're sort of playing into. Watase does it over, like basically hits that button over and over and over again. And I kind of, I watching through the show, I was like, okay, no, I see what you're doing here. Like, yeah, it's kind of annoying and problematic, hashtag capital P problematic. But I get the psychology behind it and why it's in there. And so, I wouldn't necessarily say that Fushigi Yugi is really, really well written. I wouldn't necessarily say that. I think it's just kind of compelling. But she hits that button over and over and over again. And yeah, I think to today's audiences, I don't think it plays very well. I think it's that stuff is aging poorly, so to speak. But if you read shoujo manga, it's still full of that shit.
Jose, too. And I think also there's some visual cues that that's what the story is going for. When this arc hits, Miyaka is no longer wearing her hair in the buns on the head anymore. It's always like loose and long.
Yeah, she's naked a lot. Like,
yeah, she starts getting naked a lot. She quits wearing her hair in the same way to make her look more mature. I mean, there's some theories that for women's hair, like they tell you never to wear your hair down at a job interview because it makes you look unrestrained and wild. You're supposed to wear it up. If anyone's, you know, wanted some job advice there, that's some of the stupid shit they tell us women to do with our hair. But it's kind of a cue of that. Her hair is down and loose and longer now and flowing, and it's supposed to be more erotic.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, this is also a show in which literally every character is in love with Miyaka.
So right.
They cannot resist her.
But that's the difference between like these characters unable to resist Miyaka and then the characters like constantly threatening to rape you, which I think is different. So like there's a great short story by Margaret Atwood called Rape Fantasies. And it's, you know, it just talks about women's rape fantasies. And, you know, and in the story, her coworkers are all talking about theirs. And then meanwhile, the main character in the story is talking about different ways of like creative ways that she would find to like escape the rape. And in that, you know, it's like a sort of like tongue in cheek, like dark satirical.
Oh, I've read this
story. Yeah. But
is there something about a lemon at one point?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But this is completely different from like something like Yui, in which like, you know, with Miyaka, there's that desire fantasy and maybe there's the bit of like, oh man, I'm going to like pin you against the wall. But if I say no, he'll definitely stop. Whereas with, like, it's definitely with Yui, it is used as a weapon. And it because it's also used as shame when, you know, to say, like, oh, you're not pure enough for this ritual or whatever. So there's it's definitely utilized in a way that I think does not play into an actual rape fantasy.
Yeah. I want to, because I was thinking about it, and in Fushigi Yugi, rape is never, like, it's always the villains threatening it, right? Like, yep.
Of course.
Well, I mean, in a lot of shoujo, like, it is the boyfriend who is threatening to assault the heroine.
Right.
Like, or actually assaulting the heroine. Like, yeah. that's honestly, like, very common. And so in Fushigi Yugi, like, there may be, like, a erotic, fantastic, or, like, fantasy element to it, but a lot of it is more threatened. I consider it to be more signified as more threatening. And like I said, there's a pragmatism to it because she's the priestess. If she's not a virgin, she can't summon the god. It's definitely used as a way of control, of imparting trauma. It is not really my train of thought like disappeared.
It's fine. This is a very complicated subject.
Yeah,
and the show uses it in multiple ways. Like, Yui is a mirror of Miyaka, so it all kind of connects. But gosh, it's complex. Like, mm-hmm. it takes some time to hash it out. So it's all right.
Go ahead.
Miyaka's first Miyaka's first genuine sexual experiences with Tamahome are positive. You know, they're like, when she thinks that, like, she's not going to be able to summon Suzaku anyway, so why bother keeping her virginity? Manage to have sex in that scene because her stomach growls, but it's very, like, it's very tender, very loving.
Wouldn't work in the real world, just like FYI, like, no one would care. No one would care. You just go make some toast or something. No one would care.
But, you know, like, and Tamahome's okay with it, that she stops because she's hungry and can't get her mind off of food. You know, it's...
Well, he's a sweet boy, so...
He is a sweet boy. Like, and that is too... That separates him from a lot of shoujo boyfriends, unfortunately.
Yeah, you ever read Blackbird?
Oh my god.
Don't read Blackbird.
Blackbird, Hot Gimmick, Boys Over Flowers. I can go on all day. I do panels about this.
Yeah, well, Fushigi Yugi is, I think it's, that stuff is, it's aging a little poorly, but I think if you understand it in context, it's not the worst thing, and you can definitely kind of make out what Watase was going for with the mirror between Yui and Miyaka and their experiences. Like, mm-hmm. It's easy to see kind of what she was going for with that. Like, here's how easily it can go the other way, right?
Yeah,
like, that's kind of what she's doing there.
Conscious of sex. Like,
yeah.
There are positive, like, there are really awesome things about sex, and there are really terrifying things about sex. And Fushigi Yugi sort of looks at both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a huge show. Like, it's so big that there's space for kind of all of it. And yeah, sure, it doesn't follow the rules of modern, you know, storytelling, but you kind of pick up what what they were laying down. Okay, so let's talk about the end of the show. Caitlin, can you summarize the end of Fushigi Yugi for us?
So they totally fuck up summoning Suzaku because, surprise, Chirico is actually Amiboshi, a warrior of Seryu, who tries to kill them but doesn't manage, falls into a stream, presumed dead, not actually dead. But that comes later. But they have also, since Amiboshi is probably dead, they think, now they can't summon Seryu normally either. So the Suzaku warriors and the Seiryu warriors are on a race to find these things called the Shinzaho, which are basically relics of the previous priestesses formed when they summoned the gods. And those can be, and the two of those can be used to summon Suzaku or Seiryu. Noriko dies trying to get one of the Shinzaho. It's very sad. I cried many, many ugly tears. Seiryu basically, after a whole lot of like doom and gloom, Seiryu gets both Shinzahos. They like they summon the god. Nakago's like, hell yeah, I'm gonna have Yui make me a god. And they go into real life modern Tokyo. And then, for some reason that I cannot remember, Miyaka is able to summon Suzaku. And so Yui's being devoured by Seiryu, basically. She's being absorbed into the god by the god. Miyaka also, Miyaka and Tamahome end up in the real world before summoning Suzaku. This part is a lot less straightforward. But Miyaka is able to summon Suzaku. There's a big kaiju battle in the middle of Tokyo. Everyone comes in for a big party. Miyaka wishes basically to fix everything. And then, but then everyone has to go back to the universe of the four gods or Tokyo, where they belong. Miyaka is separated from Tamahome. Oh, boo-hoo. But wait! Who's that coming down the street? It's Tamahome! What? The end.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, honestly, I like, in my opinion, the second half is so much weaker than the first half. Like, just story-wise, it just starts coming apart. And it's still interesting and everything, but it kind of starts falling apart a little bit. And it's also kind of hard to care at that point because so much melodrama has happened that you're like, all right, what's next? Okay, all right. You know, like, give me the next thing. I don't know. I don't necessarily really love the end of Fushigi Yugi. I think it's just dramatically stronger in the first like 25, 26 episodes. Lindsay, what'd you think of the end of Fushigi Yugi?
So yeah, the ending's really convoluted. I mean, they meet up with some Genbu warriors too at one point. Like Yui and Miyaka both get three wishes when they summon stuff. And so Yui uses her wish so that Miyaka, she first uses the wish so Miyaka cannot summon Suzaku, and then finally uses her last wish so that she can. And that's, I think, how Suzaku gets summoned. And then I don't remember what Miyaka like undoes Nakago and then undoes Tokyo. There's another wish in there. And that's why they get separated. While the rest of the gang, like in the book, like just go have a war. They just go have a war and die in war. That's not really interesting at all. Everyone gets really sad because, you know, like Mitsukake is, like, uses all of his healing power or whatever. He just dies. It's just tragic and shit. So my opinion on the ending is that I feel like the second half is way too long. I don't know, like something, I'm not sure where I would cut stuff. Maybe cut out the whole subplot where she's like living with Amiboshi for a little bit and the whole like forgetfulness leaves. Yeah, although that did introduce sort of an interesting conundrum. Like if you were a victim of sexual assault, would you choose to forget it or not? It's kind of interesting to think about. You know, her and Tamahome finally get to be together forever. Can't really argue with that. That's nice.
I suppose.
That's nice.
Bamboo, what about you?
Look, I literally just watched this show not that long ago, and hearing you explain the synopsis sounded insane. I had to stop and be like, wait.
Is that what happened?
Is she doing a bit? Like, is she joking? And I had to remember, like, no wait. Yeah, this sounds familiar. But it's bonkers and kind of forgettable. Like, there's some good scenes in there. Like, when you see some of the characters again, like, that's sweet. But a lot of it is really bizarre and wild. And I really feels like maybe at some point her editor was like, hey, you got to keep writing these pages. And she was like, I don't know. Here's just whatever is, like, coming out of my head while like, I'm sitting on the toilet.
We haven't even talked about like the whole Miyaka's brother and his friend subplot that's going on in the background entire goddamn time.
Right. What's up with that?
I think that entire thing should have been cut. We didn't really need it. It was all just lead up to find a reason why they'd be able to come over onto Earth or whatever, and from their world or something. Like, we see like one of the priestesses die because she actually fulfilled the wish and was able to come back without, you know, dying due to like god sex, which is totally why you have to be a virgin, is because you have to consummate with the god. You have to hook up with human god forms and just get it on to get your wishes granted.
Yeah, no, like when Yui summons Saryu, like her like hands clenched and her toes curl, I'm like, the god just gave Yui an orgasm.
He did. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Which 12-year-old me did not get.
No. Nope.
At all.
As an adult, though, you're picking up on all of it, though. You're like, oh, I gotcha. Okay.
No. Like, I think that's why they spent that whole arc talking about coupling and how it has to do with your life force or whatever, and the whole like having sex with Nakago subplot is also that when they got to the very end and they said you had to couple with Suzaku, you're like, oh, couple. I know what that means. They're gonna fuck. That's what this that is.
And also, like, don't some birds have like barbed penises? Like, that's what I'm
bamboo. That's cats.
I thought it was like ducks. I thought ducks also.
Maybe ducks.
No, they're corkscrews.
Okay.
All right.
What did you think you were gonna get out of a sec? Don't act surprised that the conversation went here.
Let's acknowledge that the best part about the ending is the actual ending with the most romantic gesture of all time, which is Tamahome being reincarnated over and over and over again just to be reunited with his one true love.
I don't think that's text.
I think that's interpretation.
No, he reincarnated all the way through time. I think the implication there is that this ancient China stuff that's in the universe of the four gods is in some way real, because otherwise how would his soul have gotten all this like this far into the future?
And I just
editorial interference.
I just realized that Gen Urobuchi totally stole this shit for Madoka. He totally lifted that. In my opinion, yeah, he's reincarnated over and over and over and over and over again for her. Until he finds her. It's supposed to, like, I mean,
it's beautiful.
It makes sense.
When I was a teenager, I literally, like, after that episode, like, I was just, at the end of the day, I was taking a shower, and I just sobbed in the shower for, like, 5 minutes. How beautiful it was.
And ever since, whenever Bamboo has met a guy, she's asked him, do you have any memories from your past life, and am I in them?
I must be, like, bitter and cynical, because I did not love that ending, honestly. I would have much preferred what Watase wanted to do, where Miyaka and Tamahome are separated, and they have to deal with it, and it's sad for them, but Miyaka has to move on with her life. Having learned and grown from the University of the Four Gods. And I also, overall, there is a stretch of really weak episodes, but I really, really love those last few episodes. Like, once they summon the gods, there are parts that don't make sense, like Tamahome's dead family holding Tsuboshi's... Why do I keep doing that?
They're twins, it's fine.
Tsuboshi's limbs, so that... like, he gets killed by his own weapon. That didn't make any sense, but overall, I really love it. I thought it was a really satisfying conclusion to the story of Miyaka and Yui making up, and Miyaka, like, and both of them growing and moving past it by drawing on, and Miyaka, like, all of the Suzaku warriors coming, that sort of her drawing on all of her knowledge and her growth throughout the story in order to find the strength to basically to fix things. Things are bad. and to be confident and to become like in a very Campbellian way, like to become an adult.
Sure.
So I really liked the ending. I thought it was a great conclusion to the story. I thought it was a great way of wrapping up Miyaka and Yui's relationship throughout the show and redeeming that. And the one part that like really always like got to me is Noriko again. The part where Noriko first materializes and Miyaka just comes over and just like falls against her with so much, just like she's so exhausted and she's so relieved to see her there. And that just always got to me because I love Noriko, and I will like cry about anything about Noriko. Like I literally sobbed even talking about like Noriko's death scene, and like that part made me tear up too.
Yeah, like Noriko is so fucking strong that she talks about how much she loves her family and then picks up a fucking mountain. Like, that's how strong that character is. It's good shit. It's good shit. Okay, let's go ahead and get into these Twitter questions. But Bamboo.
Zach, I have a confession to make.
Oh, yeah?
Which is a dark part of my past. So when I watched Fushigi Yugi, I was in junior high. Mm-hmm. And my best friend and I, for over a year, we had a spiral notebook that we would pass between each other where we wrote a massive 400-page self-insertion fanfic where we were both Mikos of the fifth god. And we had this... We had this like elaborate origin story. The fifth god, he was like a horse. There was some reason why like he got kicked out of the four. There was this whole thing, and like we just wanted to, like the wish was to make him like reunite the five. It was some ridiculous thing. And the most embarrassing thing, two embarrassing things, which was that we used in the dialogue super shitty Japanese that we just pulled straight from the insert songs for Fushigi Yugi.
It's pretty good.
And we had really embarrassing Miko names.
Well, do you remember what they were?
Yes, I do.
Will you tell us?
Yeah. Is that a cut too deep?
Okay, this cuts real deep. And I want to reiterate that I was maybe like 13 or 14 or however old I was. Probably.
We already forgive you. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
Trust me. No judgment here.
Yeah, this is adorable.
Oh, God. Obake no sake no Miko.
What? Oh, wow. My,
Yeah,
that's good, man. That's good. You should mail that to Watase, and she'll just turn it into more.
You'll get like a one shot.
Yeah, more fucking Fushigi Yugi.
Man,
400 pages.
I had a self-insert fanfic where I paired my stand-in character with Hotohori.
Uh-oh.
Nice.
Uh oh.
So we didn't have a color printer at home, and my dad did at work. So I would give him discs of key art that I wanted him to print out for me, that I could like redraw them as fan art. And at some point, like my friend who was like a huge Noriko fan, she had this little Noriko like shrine in her closet, and I would like draw a lot of fan art for her. And like there was, I'm not proud of it, but I did draw Noriko as a centaur.
Okay.
Rippling centaur.
If you still have that, if you ever regain access to it, I need to see it.
I'm pretty sure it's somewhere. It's horribly embarrassing.
My tale of Fushigi Yugi is so I'm old and was in an anime club in the middle of the 90s, and we watched Fushigi Yugi, but we were using shitty old, you know, fan sub VHS. Thing is, on some of those fan sub VHS, they didn't really think too much about whether or not the subtitles would be all that legible on a like crappy college projector. So we were using this shitty college projector, and you could not read, unless you were sitting really close, you could not read what the fuck was going on. So I sat up, and I read it aloud, and, I did voices.
Oh, boy.
So I had a Miyaka voice, because of course I did. I had a Miyaka voice, I had a Tamahome voice. Like, I did the whole thing.
This is like those like Rocky Horror Picture Show play alongs, only it was just Zach and Fushigi Yugi.
Reading Fushigi Yugi aloud to kids in the late 90s, yeah.
You have to reenact at least two refrains of Miyaka Tamahome. Please,
if there is ever a like discotheque style re-release, we need an audio track that is just Zach doing his voices.
I'll do them all. They're right there in the back of my memory. I can still do it. Miyaka! I can still do that. Tamahome! Yeah. Yeah, good.
My favorite part, though, is like the ending theme would always come in at the worst parts. Like someone would die.
Yeah, I need that. I need that ending music to play when I die. I need it to.
It's like an old, like the old school version of the roundabout meme.
Oh, right.
Sure.
They did use the theme song as a joke one time to very good effect.
That is one thing I should mention is that Fushigi Yugi has an fucking outstanding soundtrack and sound design. Like,
yes,
it's extremely compelling. Like, I don't know why more people don't steal from it because it's so good. Like, now the average episode of Fushigi Yugi has about 15 minutes of content in it. You know, between the endless recaps and the, you know, it gets to the da 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 like real fast. But it's, I still feel like it's really, really strong sound design. Like,
I watched 52 episodes of this show and I never skipped the opening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that would
did
be
not
sin.
Wasted a whole bunch of time I didn't have to. If you add up all the 2.5 minute cuts that I didn't skip over the last 2 weeks, but I never skipped it.
Oh my God, I still know all the lyrics.
Well,
oh, really?
Open up
did
to
you
infinity.
Guys ever listen to all of the like character image songs?
Yes.
Yeah.
I bought
like,
those
the
CDs.
Yes. And the one I always laughed at was the one that starts like, "We are THTC."
Yeah. A lot of those image songs were garbage. They were pretty bad. But
they're a leftover thing from like the shoujo era where you used to like release all of those. I mean, I guess they kind of do it with female idol shows now, but back then, like the Angelique franchise had like a whole bunch of image songs. They did it for Tenchi Muyo and stuff too.
They sure did. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now I had all that shit. I think I still have my Sanmei bootleg version of the first soundtrack. I need to find that shit. It's around here somewhere. Anyway, all right, let's get to some of these Twitter questions. Okay, Groovin asks, how do you think the series and themes hold up by today's standards? Do you think this series has aged well? Caitlin, let's go with you.
I think the themes, when people are willing to pay attention to them, hold up very well. Like I've said, I've put a lot of thought into Fushigi Yugi's themes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're still very strong and still very universal and still very relevant to particularly a young woman's experience. But people look at it and they see like everything about it that's kind of like outdated and they don't really give it the chance. I honestly, sincerely believe it is one of the strongest, like, metaphorical coming of age stories that I have ever watched / read / whatever. But it is, people are more prone to uncharitable interpretations because it's oldness for girls.
Agreed. Agreed. Lindsay, what do you think?
I'm kind of in the same boat. I think it still holds up pretty well. It's still compelling. It's still fun to watch even now. I think there's some slower parts or some parts that kind of lag. For 52 episodes, it's still kind of a long watch, but there's nothing like outstanding in it where I watched it. It was like, that really like turned me off. I think anyone could probably put it on and still find it entertaining.
Oh yeah, for sure. Definitely agreed. Bamboo, what do you think?
I'm surprised by how bingeable it is.
Yeah.
Like, you start watching it, you just don't stop. I mean, it is very 90s. Like, there are, not just the aesthetics, but there are, like, character tropes and themes that, again, very much a product of the 90s. But you put it on and, like, not that I know from experience, but suddenly, like, 14 hours has elapsed.
14 hours have passed and you've cried 5 times.
Why is he lifting that boulder?
All right. From GW Otaku. Question: do you feel like all the tragedy and violence directed at Miyaka made her too much of a victim in her own story? Or is there enough there to sell the tale as overcoming adversity with her positive traits and the power of love? What do you draw the line? Is it possible to? First of all, yes. To answer this myself, there is enough there to sell the power of love. That's what the show is largely about, in my opinion. Caitlin, what do you think?
I think it gets really hairy there for a decent stretch of episodes in the second half. I wish that Miyaka did have more chances to be an active character. And instead of think like the part where like she just takes Hodohori's sword and she just like, fucks shit up with it, is really great. And I wish we had more moments like that, but I still think, I don't think that is enough to like make her just a victim in her own story. She still does a lot of, she still accomplishes a lot. She still grows a lot.
She solves so many problems just by talking to people. Just by talking. Just by like, hey, calm the fuck down. Calm the fuck down. Let's talk. Like, that's what she does over and over and over again in that show.
And that's the thing with her and Yui, is Yui won't talk.
Right.
Yui, like, and when there is a moment where it seems like Miyaka might have a moment to talk with her, they make it so she can't. And so the misunderstandings continue.
Yeah. It's pretty direct. I don't think it's super subtle. Lindsay, what do you think?
Would have liked there to be a little more proactive, especially like after they try something, Suzaku, and it fails, and she's supposed to sort of get like more secret power from the ashes from the old lady person. We also never talked about, but that's fine. There's an old lady.
Yeah, I brought a tight scoon.
I would have liked to see her maybe grow into a more physically active role or something. I don't know. Yeah, because there's definitely some places in the end where, I don't know, I just kind of felt frustrated how she always seemed to be a victim of her circumstances. But I still, like I said, the show's still really compelling to watch. It's very easily bingeable, even if she's not the most, like, I was going to say proactive, but she is proactive.
Spunky.
She's spunky at times, yeah. It's just not,
Well, it's from the early 90s. Like,
yeah,
she stabs herself.
Your expectations can only be so high. Like,
yeah, yeah.
like the moment where she stabs herself to me was like a huge turning point personally for me, for Miyaka, because like not only was I super baller, but like that in that moment, you know, she has the choice and makes that decision to do so.
Yeah. Are we talking about when she's inside the mirror or?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Well, we didn't talk about evil Miyaka or evil Kamehame. But geez, if we get into every single soap opera turning point on this one, it'll take forever. So, yeah.
Then you would have what we did with Annie Femme, where we just went through episode by episode and is literally hours of podcasting.
Yeah. All right. Right. Exactly.
If you want that, you know where to find it.
Head on over to Anime Feminist. all right. Next question is from Onikuno. Did anyone own or rent Fushigi Yugi on VHS and get confused when Pioneer named it Mysterious Play and was assumed it was a different show?
I literally did not notice when I was checking the videos out of the library.
Did anyone, he says, does anyone but me decide to drop $200 on those early Pioneer DVD sets?
Yep.
The answer is yes.
Oh, yeah.
Remember those? Those thick box sets? Boy, those came down.
Those were nice sets.
These were good looking.
They're interlaced and don't look that great. But
the box looks nice.
The box does look really nice.
The box. Yeah. The box looks great.
Those do look good. I remember I think you can still find that sometimes in used DVD stores, like used media stores. They came down in price real fast. But they would still charge, like, if you found it in, like, a used record store, it would still be, like, $75 or something like that. For Fushigi Yugi. All right.
I mean, that's like a dollar an episode, almost.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, I paid $15 an episode for Ranma, so.
Oh, geez. Yeah, I remember that, too. Lindsay, do you have any?
I remember seeing the VHS tapes at Suncoast, but I never owned it on home video.
All right, then. Okay. Our friend of the show, Bunny Cartoon, asks, back in the day, Miyaka got a lot of hate. What are your thoughts on her? And do you think now that a significant amount of time has passed, people have maybe changed their opinions? Well, we kind of
talked about that.
Yeah. We talked about this a little bit, but my answer is definitely yes. Definitely yes. Miyaka is a misunderstood heroine. And whenever she's on screen in the show, which is fucking constantly, I appreciated what she was doing, and I got what Watase was going for. I got it. I was like, okay, I got you. The heroine of this show is basically uses empathy to solve all of these problems. Like, it's pretty good, I think.
She's not book smart. She's street smart.
Yeah. She's not really street smart either.
She's emotionally intelligent.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
She cares about people.
She cares about things. Cares about people, cares about things. Also, likes food and boys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which, who doesn't like those things?
Exactly.
I like food.
Yeah.
okay. CC Takato asks, do you think we'll ever get an anime adaptation of Fushigi Yugi Genbu Kaiden?
I think that boat sailed if it was ever going to happen.
Yeah, I think that the kind of isekai that Fushigi Yugi is has gone out of fashion, and it's been supplanted by the reincarnation stories.
Consider this, though. Literally everything from the 90s is being shoved back into your face because nostalgia sells. So,
well, yeah, but not anything for women, though.
Do you guys remember when she released those drawings of like what the characters would look like now if she were to do it again?
Oh, yeah, we wrote that for interest, Bamboo.
Like, that could, I mean, I could totally see a reboot.
It's probably going to happen.
I'd watch it.
I would watch the fuck out of that.
Of course you'd watch the fuck out of it.
And it's still popular because not that long ago they even had that stage play.
Yeah, and if they did Genbu, I mean, I liked the priestess design for the Genbu one, the girl with the braids.
Yeah.
It'll have. Look, if they don't fruits basket this shit, I'll be stunned. Like, you're leaving money on the table if you don't fucking fruits basket this thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Let's see. X-Styla says, love to get your thoughts on the music of the series, Eikoden included. Say what you will of Eikoden, but the soundtrack was incredible. As we said, unbelievable sound design on this thing.
Just great.
It's flawless. Okay. Felicia says, Tamahome or Hotohori? Now, Caitlin, we'll start with you.
Fuck Hotohori. Tamahome all the way.
So you're saying fuck Hotohori and marry Tamahome?
And then kill Nakago.
You know what? That's fair. Sure.
Bamboo, I already know your answer.
Wow, but you know what? Fuck Toski. Marry Tamahome. Kill the twins.
There you go.
I like how our response to this question has evolved.
It's changed a little bit. Lindsay, what about you?
Oh, man. Oh, no. Do I have to answer honestly?
Yes.
All right. Okay.
Uh-oh.
We already know where I'm going with this, don't we?
Oh, God.
We already know what's going to happen, right?
All right.
So we're gonna fuck Nakago, and then we're going to...
We're going to marry...
You know what? We're going to marry Mitsukake because I bet he's a good guy and he's just nice and he'll take care of you and he's got a good job.
He's got a cat.
He has a cat and he has job security. Okay. He's a doctor. All right. They're always going to need those. And then we're going to.
Ooh.
And then we're going to kill.
Woof.
Ooh. What? What?
That's just some like normie dad love.
Have you met my husband, Bamboo? All right, and then we're I guess yeah, we'll kill the twins. I'll go with you on that one. That's a good call.
My answer to this question is hold hands with Nuriko and tell her that she's valid. That's my answer.
Aww. Aww. That's cheating though.
It's cheating. I always cheat. Anyway. let's see. Different years from Jeff, our friend Jeff, a friend of the show. He asks, different years. So this is likely an apples to oranges comparison. But what is your opinion on the isekai mechanism? Is it better to be transported to another world or be reborn there? Huh. Caitlin, what do you think?
I speaking in terms of what I would prefer to experience and also... what I prefer narratively, I prefer the transported model because narratively speaking, it works better as a framing device for like the sort of coming of age story. It's easier for it to really be about something, which is more appealing to me. And also like I like my life. Like those reincarnation stories are generally about people whose lives are like really like shitty for some reason. And like, you know, if I were like reincarnated, but I still had my memories, like I would miss my husband. I would miss my job. Like I would miss my friends. I would miss flush toilets. So like yeah no I'll definitely all the way being transported.
All right, Lindsay, what do you think?
So yeah, this is an interesting conundrum. If I'm reincarnated, then I don't know what I'm missing from back at home, right? But if I am transported, then I have all of my smarts that I have now in some other, you know, so I might have an advantage if I'm transported versus reincarnated. But then I want to come back. See, if you're reincarnated, you don't have anywhere you want to go back to. So that's sort of the stakes there. I'm gonna pick transported, I think.
All right. Bamboo?
Transported, because there's no place like home. That's the best narrative device ever. You're always wanting to go home.
Yeah, like Escaflowne, right? You know?
Yeah.
Transported. That's the way to go. The reincarnation thing seems like I don't have any memories of my previous life. You know, that's kind of like, the power fantasy is transported. That's the power fantasy, I think.
I'm a famous war general, but now my breasts are gigantic.
Yeah. Oh no, it's Oda Nobunaga for the 400th time.
I just can't get rid of that guy.
Who that legitimately sounded like a light novel title.
Yeah, it probably and now it probably totally will be. Here's a good one from Nancy. Nancy at Viz asked, if you found a copy of The Universe of the Four Gods, would you open it up and read it? Lindsay, you're first.
Oh, boy. No. But I would give it to someone I really don't like, so they would open it up and read it.
Caitlin, what about you?
What if they get to make a wish?
modern me? Probably not. Because, listen, that's for finding yourself and growing as a person.
I see.
I'm still working on that, but I think, but for 1999 me or the year 2000 me, I think that would be a good and useful journey.
All right, Bamboo.
Maybe without all the assault though.
Sure, Bamboo.
Absolutely yes, because imagine the press tour you could do afterwards.
Oh wow, yeah.
My answer, of course, to this is fucking immediately. Immediately, if I saw, I would be like, oh shit, hang on, let's read. I'm going.
Zach is just gonna leave me with all this work so that he can go inside that book.
No, you would be the one reading the book.
That's probably true. That's probably true.
You would be the Keisuke.
All right, let's see here. Amorphous Being asks, Tsuboshi or Amiboshi? Caitlin, let's start with you.
All right, well, now here's my embarrassing past. I really had a soft spot for Tsuboshi for a long time.
Really?
I blame it on watching the series out of order. So I saw the parts where he was like being like sad and vulnerable before the child murder. I've also always had like a soft spot for twin characters because I myself am a twin.
I didn't know that. And I feel bad about something I said earlier. So I'm sorry.
But nowadays, neither. They both suck in their own ways. Like... Amiboshi, like, does some, like, even... He tries to force Miyaka to lose her memories. And that's not okay. That's not cool.
Yeah, well... Yeah, all right. Bamboo, do you have a take on this one?
No, they're both terrible. Yeah. Of those two, I would say Tsuboshi.
Lindsay?
Whichever one didn't kill the kids.
Yeah. Nope. The answer is thumbs down on both of these motherfuckers. Nope.
Who was the one with the flute? That was Amiboshi, right?
That was Amiboshi.
Yeah, see, that whole flute thing, that's a hard pass, so. Yeah. By default.
It's not a sexy instrument.
It's so piercing the way
he plays. What if he played like the saxophone or something instead?
Oh.
Then it would be okay.
Man.
Classic guitar?
Okay. Oh, right.
The amount of saxophone in the soundtrack is fucking amazing.
So good.
It's real fucking good.
That was a spot on impression.
Real good. All right. Okay. Danger Eskel asks, great opening song or the greatest opening song? I would actually, I think, maybe rank... Mugen Hieto Hirage Fushigi Yugi above even Cruel Angel's Thesis. Like,
it's
really incredible.
It's fucking amazing.
It's like, definitely in my top five, but I don't know if I'd put it ahead of Cruel Angel's Thesis.
I think I put it ahead of Cruel Angel's Thesis. Like, I'm here with you.
These are close, you know, one and two, but that song is fucking amazing. Like,
the way it moves from like the very like ethereal part into like the peppy pop music.
Yeah.
And oh my God, so good.
It's real strong. Like, there's like electric guitar and shit in there. Like, it's really good. It's really
and, like,
powerful.
Trumpets.
Yeah, the trumpets. Like, it's, yeah, it's a huge piece of music. Like, it's real good.
There's, I think they use it like near the end of the series, but there's that like soft piano acoustic version of the opening theme. That's really good.
That's good too. Yeah. Mm. Whew. Boy, the music in that show.
The first OAV was a hot mess, but the theme song was very good. Not as good as the TV series theme song, but it was a very strong theme song.
Probably not as strong, though.
No. Nothing. I mean, nothing's as strong.
Like, if I ever start a cover band, man, we're definitely doing that. I'm like, hang on. Hang on. Here's one for you.
There's going to be so many confused people in that tavern.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, but the only music more jarring than the first few notes of the ending theme were like the Eye Catch tunes.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Because it'd be like, this weird. Yeah.
But it definitely matches like the extremely strong kind of very punchy sound design of the show. Like, the music is covering for like a lot of repetitive bullshit, like, but you get excited because the music is great, you know.
Yep.
All right, Caitlin's friend Vry asks, what lessons could modern isekai or shoujo fantasy adventure in general learn from Fushigi Yugi?
Oh, I got this one. Make them about women and girls.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. Isekai used to be, I mean, there were a general audience isekai, and there was isekai aimed at boys, but isekai for a long time was associated mostly with shoujo. And I think that isekai of that era is much stronger. Make it be about something.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bold yeah. stance to take.
Like, most modern isekai is so boring because they get there. It's like, look at me. My life sucked before. And now I have all these cool powers and I'm super powerful and everything is easy for me. And oh, hey, look, I have a slave. So cool.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, no, sorry. They're not about anything. They don't have any point of view.
I would love to see like turn this genre turn on its ear and see like an isekai, but like an office drama. Just something like maybe you get transported to like, I don't know, the 1920s and suddenly you're like an insurance broker.
What?
You know?
And then you just have to figure that out, I guess.
How did insurance work in the 1920s? I don't know. Did it collapse along with the banking system? Let's find out.
What if it's like isekai or like isekai Mad Men? Yeah, there's a lot we could do with the other genres that like Hollywood is obsessed with. Like, we could just combine these two things.
Yeah. I don't know. I agree with Caitlin on this one. Like, just fucking make it about something, please, other than just bullshit power fantasy where, hey, now I'm in a fantasy world and all these ladies want to fuck me and then that's it. Like, all right, okay. It's boring. That's super fucking boring. It's like capital C content. It's not really about anything. What would you do though?
Like what would your ideal thing be? Like, the only thing I can think of is like maybe traveling back in time to prevent something or to like save the planet or something.
There's a lot of things you could do with it, I think. I can't come up with something right off the top of my head. but it helps when the person who is writing it has a theme in mind and is trying to express something other than, well, friendship. Well, comma, there's money to be made. Like, express something other than that. Like, that's when it's good. So I suppose that's my response to that. Reed, friend of the show, asks, how much shorter do you think the show should be optimally paced? Personally estimate roughly half a season, maybe a bit more. I agree with Reed. This could have been so much shorter.
Okay, wait. When he says half a season, is he talking about like one coor or like two coors?
I think he's talking about like 12 episodes.
I don't think you could reduce it to 12 episodes. I'd say maybe 26.
You could do it in 20. Well, okay. Now, you certainly couldn't do it in 12. But 26, definitely. I think so. What do you think, Caitlin?
I would do probably... I'm torn between like 39, like tell it in 39, mm-hmm. or keep the 52, but have like replace the bullshit with like more like of the characters interacting, like at give some development to Mitsukake and Chiriko so that like we actually care about them. But like, I wouldn't cut it down past that. Like, I would not cut it down shorter than 39. I think it would get too compressed if they did that, if they went shorter than that.
Well, but what if you redesign the story a little bit? Like, what if you, like, yank out all of the filler kind of bullshit that's in there?
What if you get rid of the stuff where she's with Amiboshi and where the magic item gets stolen by a dog? What if we just, like, kind of got rid of that?
Exactly.
I mean, I don't want to change too much because part of what I like about the series is that it is so raw, and it is messy in a way that I think really works for the themes.
Hmm.
Like, you know, like Watase was like an inexperienced storyteller when they wrote it. Like, they're 22 years old. Like, the themes that they were working on were really resonant with like their own lives and experiences and points of view. So I think like Genbu Kaiden like did a good job like of really refining a lot, but it felt a lot less raw, and I don't like it as much as the original version, even though it's a much more polished story. So I really like, I wouldn't change that much.
Yeah, well, it's a good show, so why would you change anything? But I could totally see it in 26. I don't think it would be that tough to do. Okay, almost done. We're almost finished. Okay, Brainchild 129 asks, who's the best villain of the series, Nakago, Tenko, or Mayo?
Are those other two from the OVAs?
They are.
Okay, then so. I don't really have a...
Yeah, I don't have a take on this other than it's Nakago. I didn't make everyone also watch the OVAs again, so it's Nakago for me. Caitlin, you got a take on this one?
I gotta say, Mayo fucking sucks in a much more teenage girl, messy teenage girl way. Like, she's just selfish and kind of mean and doesn't think of anyone else. So, but Eikoden is a really awful story. So it's hard to say. Mayo is actually a pretty good villain in a not very good story. Yeah, it's a toss up.
Okay. From Zaku. Somebody else who calls himself Zaku. What would you consider to be the modern equivalent of this series? Lindsay, let's start with you.
Modern equivalent of Fushigi Yugi. God, that's hard.
That's a tough one.
And I feel like anything that has the same kind of like melodrama, like the first show that comes to mind when I think of anything that has the same sort of like melodrama coming of age themes, but it's not transported to another world, and it's not even modern, but it's Peach Girl. That's the only thing I can think of.
That's like contemporaneous with Fushigi Yugi.
Yeah.
They're the same era.
Yep.
Fushigi Yugi's a lost art then. There isn't one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in my opinion, it's a singular work. It, as a piece of art, deserves to be considered on its own, and is worth considering on its own. Mm-hmm. Caitlin, what's your take?
Yona of the Dawn probably has the most superficial similarities. It's really the only like current like action fantasy shoujo that's like in English. There might be something super obscure in Japanese that I've never heard of, but like even then, like it's a very different kind of story told in a very different way. It has a like reverse harem destined warrior sort of thing, but and like the coming of age thing, but it's a really different kind of story.
Bamboo,
would you consider Fruits Basket to be similar but different? Like obviously it's not, you know, she's not going to the past, they're not blah 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 blah, but a bunch of dudes, many of whom like her, and it's a coming of age story.
An empathetic heroine.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
She is tossed into something, you know, vaguely supernatural.
True. Yeah. I actually did think of that, like looking at it on my shelf.
That's good take. That's a good one. I think that's probably true. good one. All right. Okay. So we are finally fucking sick. Fushigi Yugi, I cannot thank you enough for putting yourselves through this with me and coming on and being such excellent. So thank you very much. Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Caitlin Moore, Bamboo Dong, and my co-host Lindsay Leverage for coming on by. The theme song is Bucharest by the band New Division. Check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on all the places that you do that on, and, you know, whatever. Anyway, see y'all next week.